Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary
with Professor Jennifer Curtin this morning. Kia ora, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
We have got some full-on topics to talk about today. I think we should start with the pretty disturbing videos that came out of Oranga Tamariki, a whistleblower showing members of the secure Oranga Tamariki facilities restraining children in very violent manner, including headlock in one of the videos as well. We've seen the fallout from this in the last day, but what, I guess, is going to be the long-term fallout from this? Because we've seen issues with Oranga Tamariki for a long, long time now. What's happening from this point, do you think?
Well, we have in place, you know, Wiri Gardner is now the interim CE, if you like, and there's also an independent ministerial advisory group that is doing an investigation and will report back in August, and we're expecting to see considerable reforms recommended. The difficulty is that with advisory groups like this, even though they do fabulous research and investigation that's needed, everything they recommended, it always takes time to implement. And the Māori Party raised this yesterday, like, what are we going to do? Are there other children at risk? And actually, yep. Newsroom has revealed this morning that that there is a one of the people in the video allegedly abused a used excessive force against a child before, which was reported, and I think, but didn't go anywhere. And I think this is the thing, that whistleblowers are feeling the need to go to the media to seek reform, because the internal processes for reporting inappropriate behaviour across a range of areas within Oranga Tamariki doesn't seem to be working. Mm-hmm. So, and this is what the interim CE said as well, like, why isn't, if these bad behaviour is being reported and nothing's changing, mm-hmm. or we're reliant on whistleblowers to be telling us what's actually going on, then this, you know, Kelvin Davis has called this symbolic. I think this is much more than symbolic. It's a really substantive problem.
Yeah.
And they're going to need to act quite quickly, because waiting for reviews and recommendations to come through isn't necessarily the answer.
Andrew Beecroft, he said that he's the Children's Commissioner. He said that it should just be bulldozed, these institutions, which was pretty strong language from him. But he doesn't really pull punches when it comes to talking about Oranga Tamariki and the reform that's needed. But I guess that phrasing came out of there's been this discussion around these secure care facilities for quite some time, and how they should be looking to be gradually phased out. That is obviously now come into acute focus. Do you think that there is any precedent or any kind of mandate now to see an immediate change? We're seeing, as you said, all of these reports and this research into it, but you know, we have got kids in these facilities who are potentially at risk. Will we see any, you know, speedy action on just removing these, full stop?
Well, you know, August, that might be the clear recommendation that now comes in. You know, it's not too late for the advisory group to actually change some of the potential recommendations that they had in there. And there is an objective to shut down these big scale, you know, facilities and put children more into residences. But as you know, this is like, you know, these are taking some time to come on stream. So whether they can, you know, bureaucracies are really slow moving. So hopefully this incident and the fact that Newsroom is being seen obviously by whistleblowers and others as the channel for getting this out, we might see even more stories emerge, which this is the kind of pressure that government needs to act fast. And with Beecroft, you know, it would be ideal if we could see something happen like now. Whether or not that will be the case is like I couldn't possibly say, but all I know is that the machinery of government seems to move slow, unfortunately.
Well, let's talk a wee bit about the Resource Management Act now, because this one has been discussed for a long time as a piece of legislation that needs to change, hasn't been working, and we are finally seeing that that is going to be happening. This is one of those rare moments where pretty much across the political spectrum, everybody agrees it needs to change. The ways it changes are less unified, I think, in the discussions that we're seeing at the moment. But probably a good place to start is, could you just give us a really brief overview of what actually is the Resource Management Act and why is it so contentious at the moment?
Okay, so that's a really big question. Because what we see is what Park has actually recommended is also really complex. Mm. But really, if I had to say it in one sentence, it's about, you know, managing the built and natural environment in such a way and regulating it in such a way that is supposed to ideally enable environmental protection, but also enable councils and regional councils to consent for building, for housing, for environmental protection in a way that ideally has good outcomes for the environment and for the people living in that environment, in cities and in the regions. But it's because so much of it sits at local government,
yep,
at regional councils, it's often been quite a devolved and not particularly integrated process in terms of its implementation. And it sort of divides people. Those who want to get things done fast, don't like too much red tape, you know, and we have pressure on housing and pressure on environment. Others see risks of going too fast, that we're not doing urban and spatial and placemaking planning in a way that is attentive to Te Tiriti, to Mana Whenua, to the environment, as well as to the housing and environmental needs in cities. So it is really complex, but what we see with this is David Parker's obviously seen this as Environment Minister, it's clearly a real passion of his to get this right and to think about it. He's using sort of that wellbeing terminology of intergenerational wellbeing. We need to get this right now. So they've got this exposure draft, yeah, which anybody who's keen on this stuff should go have a look at, because it's out for public consultation. It's not like a foregone conclusion yet, but it is sort of focusing on much more on centering the environment, which is really, and thinking about environment in a very, you know, trying to capture habitats, ecosystems, coasts, estuaries, freshwater, soil, biodiversity, air. There's, you know, it's the whole shebang in a really important way, but also centering Te Tiriti in the process of planning for implementation. So it's kind of exciting. It's just like getting your head around the details is going to be challenging for some of us, because there are probably going to be three pieces of legislation that have to come out. I mean, the interesting thing is that the Select Committee it's going to is the environment one, which is chaired by Eugenie Sage. This is what's kind of made Judith Collins a little bit hot under the collar. She's called it wokeism.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Is it as inflammatory? Is it as inflammatory? Is it as radical as, I guess, Judith Collins and perhaps some of those politicians who are not so keen on the government's proposals? Is it as radical as they would like us to think it is, perhaps?
I think, you know, when you read down into her comments, I mean, Collins is playing a bit of wedge politics on a whole bunch of issues right now, so we shouldn't be surprised to see her going on the offensive and then using this kind of flowery language that she uses when she's deriding a government recommendation. But really, when you read down into it, she's concerned about whether the housing will take too long to build, because when you look at who supports this, while some in the media are setting it up as if there's, you know, a lot of opposition and then a lot of pros, people who are pro, and that there's this really clear divide, it doesn't look like it's necessarily traditional partisan divide if you look at the interests. You know, there are regional bodies that are related to, you know, what we might otherwise think of as conservative interests who want to see this happen as well. So I'm not sure that the opposition is as entrenched as what we might be led to believe, and this will be Collins getting her headline, perhaps, and she got it, you know, because that's what people are focusing on.
Well, let's talk very briefly, because I'm aware we're running out of time, but we should touch on... No, it's been great. Really good discussion around it. I just want to touch on the hate speech law reform and recommendations that have come in, because I guess that's another thing that's been perhaps pitched in the media as something that it's not necessarily. I think a lot of the issue seems to be coming down to it's very hard to define what hate speech is and also what that might look like in practice in the law. What are some of your big, I guess, takeaways from the initial things we've seen proposed by the government around how to manage hate speech in the country?
So, first of all, I would say if people really want sort of a clear legal take on this, there's on Public Address website, there's a guy called Graham Edgler who's writing blogs on this, and he has a really clear understanding of law, and he's really good at writing this out for public consumption. But essentially, this is a reform to an existing act, and in some senses, it's taking out some of the archaic language around exciting, you know, hostility and so on. And it's looking to decriminalise some of the things that were in there about that you could be charged with before, and it's upping the groups. It's a group. It's not if I were to abuse you. It's about the focus is on groups and hate speech and inciting violence and hostility against groups. But what has been expanded is the extent to which the inciting of violence and hostility has become a more of a criminal offence with a bigger, you know, penalty and so on, but it's also expanded the groups that this act applies to. So we already have it's illegal to discriminate against on the basis of religion and so on, and gender identity. But now those discrimination categories are looking to be brought into the hate speech part of the reforms. So in a sense, it's not as big as I think. What the issue here is that our ministers have been unable to explain it clearly, and so people are now thinking, oh, that means I can't yell abuse at my neighbour without the risk of, you know, being prosecuted.
Yeah.
And I think we saw this with what we used, you know, in inverted commas, called the anti-smacking legislation.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of fear that the general person on the street was going to be picked up and prosecuted, but it's not like that.
No. Well, thank you very much for your time this morning, Professor Jennifer Curtin. It's always great to have you on the show. Enjoy the rest of your week, and we will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Rachel. Stay warm.
Yes, you too. Ka kite.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.